if you were in a position of power where you can actually broadly influence things that mm-hmm. are tied to this, then like if you're a person, if you're listening to this podcast and you're the CEO of a coal company, then mm-hmm. maybe burn that thing to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, no, don't do because it.
Bury it or something.
Bury it. Put it back in the mountain.
Put it back in the mountain. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 234 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm real chill right now.
I'm Sam, and I've got no chill right now.
This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is November 16, 2019. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be swears.
Up and down.
In this episode.
Paint them on the wall.
Yeah. All right. Listen.
I'm telling you, I'm real chill right now.
It's so chill.
Listen. Yeah. This episode is the first of two that we're going to be recording back-to-back
today,
because
– and you may be thinking as you're listening to this, today is not even close to November 16th.
Correct.
That's right.
That's true.
That's because both Adam and Seth are going to be gone. So we're going to be
– we're pre-recording these two episodes, which means we don't have a lot to say, but we do have a lot of questions from our listeners. And just generally.
And about the universe.
Yep. Yeah. So we're going to – take this opportunity to answer those questions, and we're just going to burn down the list. But first, Sam has a story.
I do. Yesterday, I go to leave the office around 4 p.m. I was a little, you know, frazzled after a full work day.
Yeah.
Like 8 o'clock. So heading out, and usually what I do is I call my wife on the way home. It's just a quick, you know, 10, 15-minute chat, catch up on the day, sort of like a, you know, just like just getting the report about stuff so that when I get home, we can just like chat and hang out. So –
you got to do your pre-chat.
So that when you get home, chat. You don't have to talk to each other.
Then you can just
that's
kind of
also probably a good reason. So get in the car, call her on the phone, and I say, hey. And she says, hey, what's up? And I say, hey, I was just calling to – and then immediately start sneezing uncontrollably for like 15 seconds.
Yeah,
just
Sam, like, for all of our listeners out there, Sam has an incredible sneeze potency.
They're just sudden. I think
they are sudden. They come out of nowhere, and they're always – there's like 100 of them in a row.
Yeah.
Every time.
So – I just said, hey, I just want to tell you. So for like 15 seconds. And
maybe she thought you fell down the stairs.
Oh, no. She didn't know. So both of us just start. I was just crying, laughing afterwards. And so I'm covered in tears now. And
it's not presumably.
And I'm just in the car. I'm still in the parking lot. I had moved the car like 4 feet to just start getting out. And the whole thing was just so ridiculous. And it was just absolutely wonderful. And I was like, this is good. This is a good day. Even though this is the weirdest thing.
This is what it's like to be alive.
Did this all start after your bone marrow transplant?
It did.
Because I didn't remember that happening.
Yeah, there's
this
one of the drugs, I think it was Vincristine, which is not a name for a person, though it sounds like it.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty nice name, really.
It is not a good drug. Yeah. So that's one of the cancer-killing ones that I had during all my chemo.
It also killed your anti-sneeze organ.
Well, so what that one actually would do is it's literally one of the things it does is it makes you feel like you need to sneeze. And that also just makes you sneeze. And so, yeah, after that, like now I just sneeze different. Like that's the one leftover I have for my cancer treatment. So I sneeze weird now, which I guess is fine.
Could have been worse.
And much more suddenly.
Yeah. I'll just be doing something and I'm like, out of nowhere.
Like, I don't think I've ever, I mean, sneezes always sneak up on it. It's kind of their whole thing. But even still, I've never had a moment where it was like, it happened and there was no. There was no feeling first.
Yeah.
You know, it just – I've never had anything like
the
that.
The side effects of cancer drugs are so fucking weird.
Yeah.
They'll be like, now this one, while we're dripping this into your body, you're going to taste creamed corn.
Yeah. That was
the next time they're
one.
Like, while we do this one, you're going to think you're a dragon for 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to want a bagel really badly. That's
next
what this
one,
drug does.
One of the other ones, they're like, next time you pee, it'll be purple. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about that.
What the fuck is going on?
Totally normal. Totally normal thing.
Totally normal.
Like this one will remove the entire lining of your intestine.
Yeah.
So that's a fun one.
There was another one where they were like, when you have this, if you don't eat ice chips the entire time, it's going to peel off the entire inside of your mouth. And I was like, what?
You're like, how many ice chips can I eat?
I ate so many ice chips that I frost burned my mouth. So I ended up peeling off my mouth anyways.
But that still seems better.
It was definitely better.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't ulcers, which was basically what it turns your entire mouth into. And there's another one where they're like, okay, well, I put this one in. It might form crystals in your eyeballs. Not even kidding. Not even fucking kidding.
And you're like, what do I do?
And
I
was like,
do I
need to worry about that? And they're like, well, if it happens, we'll worry about it.
If it happens, you'll know.
Okay. What is happening?
Poison, man.
While you're getting these drugs, the way that you perceive life and death will turn inside out.
I mean, that's really true. Know, 100%
true. We don't really know what that means exactly, but it will happen.
Yep.
Yeah, that's... I mean, at least you came out with just the sneezes.
Yeah, just
at least none of these things were permanent.
Yeah, no, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, actually, it is very impressive how few side damages you got.
Yeah, well, this is actually – so speaking of, I had my cancer treatment sort of checkup last week. And yeah, they were like, you are healthy as a horse, sir. So –
I hope a good one, because horses
– real good horse.
Horses got a whole range.
Like a whole range. Yeah, I'm definitely like a good horse, sort of healthiness level.
Healthy as a good horse.
So this is year four, which means I have 1 year left before I can get life insurance. Because after 5 years, they're like, probably it's fine. Mm-hmm. Even though my doctor was definitely this year, she was like, you're definitely fine. You're going to be good. But I still have to wait a year for insurance. I'm not cured yet, apparently, according to insurance companies.
You know what's funny, though, is when we go get our life insurance, yours is going to somehow cost less than mine.
I know.
That's what's going to happen.
Because they won't know that I had cancer once anymore. Because
you can hide it.
Yep.
And hopefully they don't.
You don't have to tell them at that point?
Hopefully they don't know you. Because they might find out.
Yeah, they're going to have to listen to a lot of podcast episodes to jig it up, though. Whatever. Yeah.
Could be. Or they'll just see your top YouTube GDC talk.
Yeah, if they just search Sam Cox. Yeah.
All right, and there's one other thing we need to talk about before we go to questions, which is some, dare I say, dope-ass introspection that Sam encountered while doing art.
Yeah, so every so often during my art practice, watching YouTube videos, student lessons, whatever else, there's some phrase someone utters that feels like a good metaphor for life generally. So the first one that I found was this idea from this fantastic tutorial series by this guy named Marco Bucci on YouTube. And it was simply, beware of shapes that are too self-important, which we have talked about in the podcast before. And for some reason, it just struck me as sort of like, it's kind of giggle-worthy and made me think about just people and also ideas.
Or Bitcoin or 3D printing.
VR, all this stuff. Yeah, where it's like suddenly everyone's like, oh my God, so important. And it's just this sort of reminder that maybe not. So there's that one. And then the new one from this morning for this class I'm taking on environment sketching and art design, we're talking about lighting. And the idea was, and it sort of like blew my lid off my head, it was one of those sentences, was that any object in your scene that is struck by light also becomes a light. Okay? It's like a simple idea. So anything that is lit lights other things with whatever it is lit by. And so it just sort of struck me as this weird, fun metaphor for – just a lot of stuff, whether it's, you know, say you're taking a self-improvement approach. So in our case, you know, Seth started doing this like not eating meat thing. I eat less meat now. Seth's sort of reflecting this vegetarian radiation onto me a little bit. And it's also, I think, a reflection of like, you got to be really careful. That whole rule of, you know, be careful who you surround yourself with, who you listen to, that sort of thing. I think it just kind of, it all comes into play in the same sort of way, because the reality is that you get hit by, you know, these – by whatever the light source is around you.
There's no dead ends. You know, the stuff that you put it out refracts. There, it's going to go all over.
Yeah.
Might come back. It's going to bounce around.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it happens in small ways, you know. Like, so you guys have been talking about, Adam, you had been talking about like the Beyond Burgers and these like Boca Burgers and stuff. And it wasn't really until just at one point randomly, I had also been listening to some other stuff about climate change and about how like I got solar panels, I got an electric car. But this whole meat thing is really kind of contradictory, you know? So
you caught yourself in a lie.
And then and then I thought, well, I mean, it seems fine because I've been hearing about it. So I did it. And then, then that sends it back out. You guys do it more. Everybody, and I don't know, maybe some of our listeners are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it all just keeps bouncing, just bounces around.
Yeah. And it gets changed a little bit too. So, like if you light an object, you know, with sunlight, for example,
then it absorbs a whole bunch of that color.
It does. But then, like, so say it's a green object, right? Mm-hmm. So it's got now this, you know, it's a bright green thing going on, but it actually will then light the things around it with some greenness, right? So whatever's lit.
Some of itself kind of.
Exactly.
Mixes in.
So there's this really, I don't know, it's like a really fun, weird beautiful metaphor that sort of popped out.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're struck by light, you light other things too. So be very careful of what light you're getting.
Because if it's ultraviolet light, now you're going to get skin cancer.
Or if it's gamma, you're going to turn into the Hulk and then turn everything into the Hulk around you.
Right. Why doesn't the Hulk turn everything else into the Hulk?
How come when I'm playing a computer game that is, you know, a AAA, like high fidelity one, and they're like, adjust your gamma, You know what I mean? And I turn it up. How come my character doesn't get stronger? That's my question.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Because they should either get stronger for like living in superhero universes or they should die for living in the real universe.
Yes. There was far too much hilarious. You turn it up all the way and everything's dead.
There was a scene. The idea of the Hulk has always been a little bit weird to me. But there's a scene, and I think it was the Hulk movie from
the Edward Norton one.
Edward Norton, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I actually watched that recently and I dug it.
It does hold up, I feel. Yeah, it was like. Fun.
What was the scene now?
But there was I think this was in this one, where he's on a table, like a steel, like a medical table thing. And he starts hulking out while he's on the table, and he gets bigger and bigger, and then the table starts to buckle.
Yeah.
Right? The whole time I'm thinking, like,
where's this mask coming from?
Yeah, where is this weight coming from? Mm-hmm. He's. Or maybe it's like his – you know how energy can convert into matter? Maybe like he's got like a core of gamma radiation in his body.
So basically when he hulks out, he's actually converting his stored up gamma radiations directly into mass.
I guess.
Ooh. The thing about that is that going that direction is really – you can't – you have to use a fuckload of – because like when you convert mass into radiation, that's how you get a nuclear explosion, right? You need a tiny amount of mass to make a huge amount of radiation. So the opposite is also true, right? Which means he has to basically be a nuclear explosion in order to get like a few grams of mass out.
Yeah.
So inside of the Hulk, that must mean he's basically the sun.
He's like a neutron star.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why he's very strong.
There we go. Yeah. We solved it. That's why the table buckles. There you go.
So, but okay. So he has all that energy, but it's pure energy. Yeah, so it doesn't weigh anything. Mm-hmm. And then he turns it into mass. That way he gets big. And then when he's done, he's like, I'm done now. And then he somehow turns it back into energy without killing everyone.
Without exploding.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I got that.
Yep. Okay. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. We're going to do a lot of them. And then after this, we're going to record another episode with even more of them.
Yeah.
And we might have to take a shot of butterscotch-flavored moonshine after this, too. We'll ponder that as we go. All right, first question comes from Mimabip Gurki, who says, what do y'all think about constantly changing tools to the latest thing? Is it better to just stay with a familiar tool and finish your work than to allow yourself to be distracted with all the new things? I'm curious if you switched to Notion from Airtable and why or why not?
Mm. I think there's sort of two phases to this. So the first is the assessment phase. I think I do think it's good to always remain curious and open to these things.
Yeah, you should try every new thing that you can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, time permitting to some degree, right?
Either, so either Scorpion.
That you can. Right, you know? Yeah. So when, you know, when we got into Airtable, for example, I think that was shortly after probably getting into something else. I don't even know what. So we hopped into it and we were like, oh, this is cool. And it sort of, it piqued our curiosity quite a bit. And so we explored it a bunch and then said, what could we actually do with this? And then the list of things we came up with that were things we couldn't do effectively with anything else was actually large. And so we were like, okay, that means this is worthwhile. Put a bunch of energy into it.
I think I think we actually did it when we were looking to make our dossier sort of press system, right? Where we wanted to keep track of all the people that we met and what they did and who they were, how to contact them.
It's basically a studio-wide contact list.
Exactly, but with a lot more information you get out of a normal, like, basically we needed a Rolodex, right? But with a lot of information on it. And so I think at the time we were looking for ways to do that.
And I
came across Airtable. I think you tried out like 10 different.
Well, I looked through a bunch of traditional contact managers, so CMS systems, which is what a lot of marketers and stuff use when they're doing email lists and all this other stuff. And I found all of them annoying because they all had a structured workflow that they require that you use.
We call that opinionated.
They were very opinionated tools.
Yeah. Self-important shapes.
Exactly. And I was like, all I need is something that lets me store information however the fuck I want. And Airtable was the only thing we found that had that extreme degree of flexibility that then went beyond the functions that a normal Google spreadsheet would have. Right. Yeah. So that was basically the question. And so we found that piece of tech, we sort of solved it with that. When it relates to – so like that's – there's always like an exploratory phase because I think you want to answer the question, how does this and how can this relate or reflect then onto the work that I'm doing right now? Mm-hmm. So I've been poking around in my spare time on – I think I explored three different painting programs recently. Mm-hmm. I did some sketchbook stuff. I used Clip Studio Paint and then I used Affinity Designer. And we're just sort of poking around to see like what do they have that I don't currently have? Mm-hmm. It's like Inkscape. And then does that difference matter?
Yeah. And can you learn something from what they're doing there and actually apply it in the tools you're already using?
Yes.
And which is usually, yes.
That's actually usually what it is. And so what I found most interesting is bouncing between vector and painting and then sort of traditional line drawing. Less so about the tools, but about the different practices. I mean, they're essentially different tools that you're using, right, to express something. They end up all sort of converging back onto my production work in Inkscape, mm-hmm. which still, by the way, like my Inkscape version is 0.48. Like I have not updated to the newest one because every time I do, despite the fact that it has a few new tools, it doesn't work actually as well.
Because they removed or changed.
Because they remove or change enough stuff that it or it just doesn't function super well, that it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I think there's it's really good to explore those things. And I think a big benefit of it is not just the reflection, but the fact that you get to say that you have been intentional about the tool you're choosing.
Yeah.
So people ask me, like, why do you use Inkscape? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I have two reasons now. So one is Affinity Designer doesn't allow for reading of XML files, which means that doing some automation stuff would require a whole new pipeline and thus mm-hmm. maybe not even be possible in some ways. Like Adam and I basically explored that, which means that Inkscape is actually a better tool than for a studio.
For pipelines, yep. Right. Yep.
When I look at Illustrator, it's because Illustrator is opinionated about several of the things that I don't like it being opinionated about. And yep. so it actually sort of gunks up my workflow in a way that doesn't actually accelerate it. It has some fancier tools, but that's fine. So it sort of it adds this ability to say – to actually say why it is that you're using something, which I think yeah. is really important. Yeah,
and all tools have opinions. The question is always how compatible are those opinions with what
with your opinions?
Yeah. yeah, and yeah, I think this there are a lot of facets to this question. So it's very hard to answer for all the reasons that you kind of said, right? Which is, but I think a lot of this also comes down to broader tooling, right? Mm-hmm. Because the more that you use a specific tool, if you're doing good production practices, the more the infrastructure of your entire sort of ecosystem of tools that you're using comes to depend on the functionality of those tools, and so. This is true in any production environment. This is certainly true in our studio. We spent months now fine-tuning and tweaking and growing the and expanding the capabilities of our build pipeline.
Yeah.
That is for Game Maker. It works for Game Maker. That has its entire purpose, right? So if we were to switch over to Unity, we not only have the cost of now learning Unity and doing all that kind of stuff there, we also now have the cost of having to rebuild our entire infrastructure that sits around that. And So this is one of those kind of hidden costs of building really strong production and building really
yeah.
really good infrastructure is that the more tools you're sticking together and the more your infrastructure is sort of built on the specifics of those tools, the harder it is for you to actually adopt new stuff over time.
Well, you could see why, so in web development, everybody hates Internet Explorer, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is that there's a lot of tools that are built specifically for
like big corporate tools.
Yeah, big corporate legacy tools that are used by hundreds of thousands of people yeah. that are not going to be updated because right. they cannot be updated.
And they were designed to work with exactly Internet Explorer and that's it.
Yeah, right? But like from the year 2000.
Yeah, I mean there are hospitals that only allow you to use Internet Explorer 6.
Or yes. Windows XP.
Or Windows XP.
Which is yeah. now 20 years
old. Completely unsupported pieces of technology. Yes.
And so it's one of those things where it's like, oh, it sucks. But at the same time, it's one of the things you always have to look out for when you're doing this tools or production development, mm-hmm. which is to say, okay, what is our future budget? What's our future plan for doing the next thing too? Because just saying that like, we're going to one and done this, make this big tool for Internet Explorer, and then that's going to be it is a very short-sighted way to think about it.
Right? It is, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. So it's that constant balance, right? Because you can't know what the next tools are going to be.
Correct.
And so you can't design your own tooling now to take into consideration whatever these imagined future tools are going to look like. And so no matter what, you're going to have to adapt things over time and things are going to change over time. And I think it also is not – it's not wise just to settle in something and have that just be the thing and that's it without exploring anything else because that's equivalent to software rot, right? That's just – if you're stuck in our case, like one version of Inkscape, right? This is actually like the older that version gets yep. versus like where we are with all of our other stuff, the more likely it is that there are things with that are going to be creating problems for us. Mm-hmm. And your inability to use updated tools or new tools with new ways of doing things because like, let's say somebody invents some really cool new super fast way to make 2D animations or something that's completely incompatible with Inkscape for some reason, right? Inkscape's not going to get updated to have that. And even if it does, because we're now on this old as fuck version of it.
We can't do it.
Then even if it does get updated, we can't update ourselves to that version because it breaks too many of the other things mm-hmm. that we need and so on. And so I think it's one of those things I think that it's really important to, as much as you can, try it. So what I do on the web dev side is I keep my eyeballs peeled.
Ew,
which is disgusting. Yes. But I keep them peeled.
You did get LASIK.
So I did get LASIK, so I did exactly that. To look out for what all the new technologies are, what all the new front-end frameworks are, and I explore them all the time. Just get a sense of what's out there, what are people doing, and are there new things coming out that I think are going to be worth shifting some of our new stuff into so that less of our infrastructure is legacy infrastructure, right? So when you have something really big, so let's say like the entirety of Rumpus, which is now this just enormous piece of software that runs our website and all of our backend tech, is huge. And so I'm not going to swap out that tech stack. That's not going to happen because the cost of doing that is just rebooting the software, right? And so it took me several years to build that. It would take me several years to build it all over again, right? So that's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that when I then go build another thing, that that also has to use the same tech stack, right? And so by keeping your eyeballs out, or just like keeping a lookout for all the different things that are changing and what they're doing and why, and then trying to learn just enough stuff that you can either apply that to the tools that you're using or make sure that your tools are as up to date as possible is all really good. And so even updating, even things like, so I'm basically now fully adopted Node is like my core programming language for everything, not just for web stuff, but for writing tools and for everything, because now I have one tool I can go to. It's one language. I can really, really learn that thing really well. But I don't use the bleeding edge version because that's not a good idea for production, right? But I use the latest, always use the latest long-term supported version, which basically a new one comes out every like 6 months or a year or something like that. And every time a new one comes out, I go update everything. Every piece of code that I've written, I install the updated version of Node and then go see what breaks and then fix all of it. I keep all of my dependencies updated all the time and so on and so forth, because if you don't do that, you just have software rot. Things get worse and worse and worse over time and harder to do.
Well, there's also a broader sort of note here, which is that it may be the case that it may not be best for your individual output to use a particular tool.
Yeah.
But it may very well be the best for the entire studio's output.
Right.
And so that's what I think about actually with
regard to – especially with infrastructure stuff.
Yeah, with infrastructure stuff. But also even with regard to Inkscape, like very few people are training up on Inkscape nowadays.
Yep.
So if you ever want to hire someone, that means that there's this other thing that's going to be happening there. Yeah. And so being able to train someone up on a tool that functions much more like something like Illustrator or Photoshop, which actually Affinity Designer is closer to, might just be the sort of thing where it's like, okay, I just need to
bite the bullet
and figure it out.
Well, it's the same deal with GameMaker versus Unity, right?
Exactly.
It's like if we wanted to hire another programmer for making games, the pool for really good GameMaker developers is fucking tiny relative to the pool for really good Unity programmers.
And so there's a lot of just other questions depending on the level that you're looking at here. I think if you're just doing a solo project by yourself, who gives a fuck?
Do whatever you want.
Do whatever feels good. But as soon as you start having like a team and you want to build a production pipeline, I think the biggest note here is that if you're actually operating as like a legit independent studio, the first thing you solve is the pipeline.
Yeah.
You solve the pipeline first. Are always asking questions of scalability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you haven't actually asked that question, like what is the tooling infrastructure that we need to make this whole thing so slick that it's ridiculous, then you're not acting as an actual production studio.
Yeah.
You're still acting basically as like a garage.
Yeah. And it is just true that the more parts you have that are all working together, the older that tech stack has to be.
Yep.
Because it gets built over time, and it gets harder and harder to change. And so that is fine. It's just something you have to keep an eye on. You just have to pay really close attention to it and make sure you're not getting yourself into trouble in the long term. But for the most part, I mean, the fact is we have a lot of work to do using the tools that we have. We can't be spending a huge fraction of our time updating the tools, learning new tools and all that kind of stuff, because we need to be continuing to actually make stuff.
But I think the truth is like most of the tools take care of the fundamentals enough that it doesn't matter so much to be completely up to date, state of the art and everything. In fact, oftentimes it's bad, right?
Yeah, well, that's true, right? Because like, if Inkscape does exactly what we need it to do, then who cares if it's 15 years old? It doesn't actually matter, right? And
right up until our needs change.
That's
the problem.
But since you can't predict what those are going to be, then it wouldn't have necessarily helped you to move to a different tool anyway. And I think about this sometimes too with if you're ever programming in the Node ecosystem, there's a million packages that people have made just at your fingertips, that do any little
thing.
Are there
a million? There probably are a million.
Yeah. I was probably a lot more than that, actually. And it's one of the funny things is like, since it's made by other people, you have to try to evaluate it and figure out, is this any good? And one of the things that you always look for is, when was the last time it was updated, right? But now imagine one of the things you're downloading is something that is so simple that all it does is say, like, put two strings together, just like something simple, right? That doesn't need to get updated.
Correct.
Right? It does not.
It does not need to happen.
It does the job.
It has a very simple
job. Yeah. So it does this kind of weird thing where anytime I look at a package, even if it is for something really simple, if I see if it was updated, a year ago or 3 years ago, I'm like, oh, I don't know about this. And this happened recently with the code that I use to do all of our authentication in Rumpus. So like logging people in through Google and all this kind of stuff, because there's a really great package out there that like kind of manages all this stuff for you because it's really confusing. But then I went to go update it at some point and noticed that it hadn't, that that package itself hadn't been updated in 2 years. And I was like, on the one hand, this process has not changed in 2 years, right? So nothing needs to have been updated. On the other hand, security is really important in this process. And I found it a really kind of hard to believe that nobody had found some little bug or something that should have been fixed. And so then I found myself in this like weird, uncertain spot where I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. So I ended up building it from scratch myself because like, then I could see it. I could know what it was doing. But it's one of those, it's just one of those weird things where it's not always the case that old is bad.
Correct.
You know?
Right. And so you, it's just, you got to be just diligent.
You just got to pay attention to it.
But I think the really important thing is that sometimes a tool will show you that there's a part of your production process that you didn't know was possible to put into the pipeline that now you can.
Right. And so it's still worth learning new tools for that reason.
Yeah. So like I took Houdini for a ride last weekend. So I built a procedural house using this whack tutorial. It was the zaniest thing. Like
Houdini's wild.
It was really crazy. Cool. And I was like, I don't know how people learn this. Like, just by I don't know what the hell's going on. This is nuts. Because basically, it's almost like vector in a way, but it's as if you were drawing, but just by typing in numbers. Like, that's what it felt like.
Awesome.
That's every day for me.
But. Yeah. But so the idea was like what you end up building is this house that you then have these four sliders on. You have the width, the height, the length, and the roof height. And you can just move the sliders around and the house just does – it just changes shape.
Yep.
And it's really cool and really weird. And I was thinking – I was like, oh, this is really neat. You know, like if we get into – if we end up tapping into 3D development, like I'm going to spend some time in there because I want to know.
You're talking like a lot of time.
But it's going to have to be a lot. Yeah.
That's the fun thing with those like really, really fancy tools that can do anything is like – the barrier to entry is enormous. Once you get in there, you feel like a god. Because you can just do such cool shit.
Yeah, I'm actually in the process of building a new tool for Sam. This is another kind of angle on this question.
We talked about it a little bit, the presentation. We talked about it last episode a little bit.
Yeah. It's always just thinking like, maybe their tool you need isn't out there. Make one.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like our game maker pipeline and everything else. Just dipping your toes into new tools. It's always informative in some way. You may not use it, but it's always good. Yeah. The next question comes from Flatpla Howlierble,
who says – that's a good one.
Who says, hey, Beastgotch bros, there's a lot of bad shit happening constantly in the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are there any big issues you care a lot about? Why do you care about that issue? What are you doing to help? And anything you recommend to cope with the anxiety that relates to tackling such a big and bad problem? Personally, I have a ton of anxiety about climate change, and it's tough to not be debilitated by it.
I heard some. There's a podcast called Ologies, which I definitely highly recommend. It's the interviewer Allie Ward just talks to. I probably mentioned this on our podcast before, but she just interviews some interesting random scientist about the work that they do periodically. And there've been a few episodes where she would be interviewing some sort of biologist or ecologist or something, who would literally break down in tears like during some part where they were talking about some of these issues, because like the stuff that they've been studying for you know 10 years or even more, like they got there and like the animals are gone now, you know, and like because these are people who are like seeing the, like they just get to go see the consequences, like they look at, they're the ones making the charts and like seeing these numbers go down, like they're the ones going out in the world and like, you know, trying to catch stuff and band it, and then suddenly there's the next year there's like they're nothing to catch now. Anything, yeah. You know, and she always asks them this question too. It's like, how do you cope with this, right? And she always asks them like, how fucked are we? And the answer has become now universally just, we're
very
just fucked.
Mm-hmm. Very.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I always find it really interesting because people say, because they always say like, yes, like this is in disaster territory. But I remain hopeful. It's like how everybody ends it. I'm like, why? What is there to be hopeful about?
Yeah. Well, because the reality is that hope is that motivating force in these scenarios.
It is, right? Like, well, there are people still working towards it, right?
You have to be working on it.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because hope, if all you do is hope, nothing's going to happen, right? But if you don't have any hope left, you also, don't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's a really weird scenario.
Yeah, I think about this in terms of on a personal level. Like, you know, I was talking about solar panels. I've got cut out meat and electric car, like trying to do stuff.
You're
personally
doing the do.
But what I also recognize is that literally doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It does not matter what I personally do.
Yeah.
And much like voting, it doesn't matter if I voted, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't, any one small contribution that I make is not going to alter the trajectory of the planet.
Well, right? but I guess the pushback on that though is it's similar to the light discussion though, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not, I think the problem is
by you doing it or talking about it, you – so the fact that like when you drive down your your driveway now, and you see there's a house down there with solar panels
yeah.
on it, right?
Yeah.
That's going to increase the likelihood that, because now every time somebody drives by, they're like, oh, solar panels, right? Like literally every time.
Well, and we even did stuff like we had to replace our roof, so we replaced it with a white roof.
Yep. Yeah.
Because it's going to not heat up the house as much, and then you don't use as much AC, and then boom.
Yeah. Well, because a lot of this is a normalization idea, right? Yeah. Which is that things that don't even affect you or that you don't even necessarily think you can contribute to or whatever, if you normalize those things and help to normalize them, then you get to spread that in some way. Even if it's very low level and it takes years to accumulate, you still get to have
that. But I think the broader point is like these are systemic problems.
Yeah, you can't fix it as an individual.
Like by yourself, you know, you can put that energy out there and you can maybe influence some people. But there needs to be something a lot bigger that has to happen. And I've kind of landed as far as it's kind of bleak, you know, but I mean, I've kind of landed as far as the climate change stuff is like, there is no way out of this.
No.
This is what's happening now.
Yep.
And because we still have people who are like, this isn't even real. And like if we're having flooded, that.
Which will happen to Venice, right?
Yeah. And then they're underwater, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know about this. So that's where we're at. And we're still having the conversation about whether a thing that is currently happening is even real and which has been happening measurably for decades and decades and decades, right?
I mean, we have anti-vaxxers. We have people who believe the earth is flat. We got
we got
all of it. And all of them seem to be rising in power with the rise of the internet.
Because what the internet does – we actually had an interesting conversation in Discord about this the other day. But the internet is very much at the center of all of these problems because – It amplifies everything that's already happening, right? So no matter what ideas you have about the world, you can find evidence to support them and you can find people who agree with you, right?
Yeah. So, and as humans, we seek confirmation bias by default.
Yeah, because it really
sucks. You have to work really, really hard personally on yourself to go the other way and try to find out if a thing is true, right? And try to find evidence against it to see if you believe that evidence and so on and so forth.
It sucks to be wrong. I mean, for most people.
You have to train yourself out of it.
You have to train yourself out of being about feeling bad about having been wrong.
Well, you talk about this even in these art training courses and stuff too. The people who end up going on to do really good things are always the people who are seeking feedback.
Yeah. Critical feedback
constantly.
Yeah.
And it's such a rare thing that there's like one out of every 100 people who's actively being like, please rip this shit up.
Yeah. So now give all these people the internet. Right. Where no matter what ideas you have, you just get to put it out there.
No matter what ideas you have, you're right.
Yeah.
And you get to to feel right and you get to be right and you get to have millions of people telling you you're right. And I think where that kind of gets us is just where we are and it's where we're going. And that's just I don't know.
Yeah,
I wish I had a good thing to say about it, but I kind of don't.
Yeah.
I
mean, we don't want to get into too much downer territory. No, but really my honest strategy is basically just to embrace the life that I have now. And just have it until whichever of these human caused crises happens, kills everybody. You know?
Yeah,
we're gonna have a plague of some sort, right? And anti-vaxxers are gonna be the thing that causes that to happen, right? That's just going to happen.
That's gonna be a thing.
Yeah, it's gonna happen. Will that happen before the Earth becomes a fireball? Because of the fireball? I don't know. Like, I don't
whatever
know
happens, it's gonna be.
Will that happen before fascism takes over the entire world?
Maybe.
Will that happen before nuclear apocalypse? Like,
could be.
I think – so there's this really good book I read called Hope in the Dark, which is basically about this idea. And the problem is that – so this the dark being this idea of you don't know what the fuck is going to happen.
Yes.
Right?
Which means you also shouldn't perseverate on it too much. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's a part of it. But the other thing is that that's also where a lot of literally completely unexpected things happen, right? Whether it's breakthroughs, whether it's completely different ideas about how to run a government or whatever else. And so it's this a really interesting idea where the point of the book is basically saying like, yeah – it's dark. Like we don't know what the fuck is going on and what's going to happen. We know some things about it, but we don't know everything. But instead of taking the approach that most people do, which is just saying like, because it's dark, everything's going to be on fire forever and we're all going to die. Like that has kind of been a thing that everybody has said for literally for all of time. Like,
well, and it's been historically true.
It has. Well,
no, as in everything has to go. This is the way humans work. Humans are dumb as rocks collectively. Like they'll
as a group
because any one of them will just believe something right, and so then you just get a whole bunch of them together, they start believing random shit, and now all of a sudden all of them do right.
It reminds me of the pigeon doing dances to happen.
So and they don't want things to change because change is uncomfortable, right? And so no matter what path we're on, we're gonna stay on that path until until the problems become so large that they are no longer deniable. And even then, most people still deny them. But at that point,
you just need enough.
The world will have been destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't mean like literally, like it's not going to fragment and be gone, or like all humans won't be dead, anything like that. Like what global warming is going to do.
It's the world as you know it.
Yes, exactly. Right? Yeah. If we live long enough to hit peak global warming. So if we get to that point, right, then the Earth isn't going to be a literal fireball. The whole thing isn't going to be a desert, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that everything –
some of it will be.
Some of it will be, definitely. But the whole thing will have changed a whole bunch, right? And it's going to be very chaotic. It's going to be very costly. It's going to be very weird. Horrible for a huge number of people.
But the thing is like this has happened over and over and over again. So whether it was globalization or it was like the fucking printing press, like everyone's like, oh my God, you're going to destroy people's brains with all these books. Like that was a concern, right? Yeah. And
I would say that's a different kind of concern than global warming.
I mean, it is different. But it's totally different kind of concern. But I think it's the same kind of concern. I think the reality of the severity of the problem is also very different, which is like definitely, world ending.
Everybody's reading now versus Venice is underwater.
Yeah. But my point there is that this cycle is just constant. And we're facing something now on a global scale that is just way more troublesome, I think, than anything we've ever faced before. And that's basically where the problem becomes a little too real because
it's not that I'm not worried about it. It's that I don't worry about it. I guess. I don't know. Anyway, it's like the act of doing it.
Yeah. So the question was how do you deal with the anxiety? Right?
It has been the case since the 50s that we were under constant threat of a nuclear holocaust to kill everybody. Right. That's still true.
100%.
Nothing has changed. Right. Mm-hmm. That could happen at any moment. Right. And so global warming is not worse than the fact that at any moment today, still, everybody could be gone.
Yeah.
That's true. So there are just more ways for this to happen, but there's still one really fast way that's just sitting there, that's been sitting there for decades. And so like, if you're going to be freaked out about a thing, I mean, there's all of it, but like, there's that, we've all forgotten
about that one. I feel like when you go backward, I feel like what just happened is somebody came in there like, my hand hurts, and you just like stomped on their foot. You're like, there, now this hurts now instead.
I think so, but I guess the question of like, what do you care about then? What are you doing? So yes, so like Seth, you're actually doing a variety of these things when it comes to basically your own personal impact on the climate change stuff.
I'm easing my own stress about it by just trying to do my part.
Yeah.
And not being annoying about it to other people, but just making an awareness about being visible.
As it relates to this, I think from my own stuff, I don't know. I think there's generally like a mental health crisis in the country. There's generally a problem with people not feeling connected to each other, with people not having direction, not knowing what they want to do, all that stuff. So weirdly enough, like I think, people have been asking us why we do the podcast too. And it actually is a meaningful thing for me every week where it feels like, just trying to help out a little bit or sort of eject some of that, good radiation.
Reaching out of the dark.
Yeah. To people to just say like, if you want to get good at stuff, go do it, go do the thing, go pick up some new tools.
Well, it's about embracing the life that you've got.
Yeah.
Like
trying to put good energy.
Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen? There's just no way to know. Yeah. Right. It has always been the case, as Sam was saying, that like disaster was actively happening or just around the corner. Mm-hmm. Right. It has always been the case. And like I said, with the whole nuclear thing, like that is
still sitting there.
That is still sitting there.
That's a very good point that everyone kind of forgets about.
It's weird, right? We just forget about that. you just have.
It's so easy to forget.
That's the weird thing, right? It's like, why do we forget? It's the same thing. Every morning you get up and you get in your car. Right?
It's because it hasn't happened.
It's because it hasn't happened. Yeah. But there's still nothing like in your normal everyday life. There's nothing more dangerous than getting up and getting in your car. That is the most dangerous thing that we do.
That's true.
In our entire lives. And we do it every day. We do it every fucking day.
And then you
day.
Get on an airplane and you're like, oh God, I hope this thing doesn't go down.
And so what you're getting like, and you could take this and be like, oh, so I guess here's now the huge list of things I should be scared about. That's not what this is about. This is about making the point about relative risk, right? Which is, we don't actually know what's going to happen with all these like really big, very scary things. We have no idea what's going to happen. We can be confident that a lot of bad things are going to happen.
Definitely.
What does that mean for any individual person? Who the fuck knows, right? We just do not know. But it's weird and it's a human trait because we cannot understand statistics and we can't evaluate problems in the world without first having an emotional response, right? Because we actually deal with way more stressful, way more dangerous stuff
all day, every day
than all of these big things that are happening, right? And so
– and a lot of these things are also very far off. abstracted and multiple layers of causation deep, you know? Whereas like being hit by a bus, that's like real now. And it's happening.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what's happening and how, and you know how the likelihood of that happening, like that's all very out in the open, you know?
But is it? It's just weird that we can, in the same way that we all become accustomed to the idea, we've become so accustomed to the idea that, that nukes are out there everywhere and could kill us at any moment, that we just don't even care about
it. Yeah, just slipped my mind.
Like literally, I can't even make myself get worried about it.
Okay, maybe thinking about it in this way, because I noticed, I was listening to the Ezra Klein show and some other things, and it was a lot of like bringing in experts to talk about current events and things like that. And I noticed that like my general outlook on pretty much everything was becoming increasingly bleak, just generally, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of hit a point where I was like, this actually changes nothing for me.
Correct.
In the sense that all these things that are happening in the world will continue to happen regardless of whether I constantly bombard myself with information about them, right? So instead of sort of becoming a quivering husk of a person, terrified of what's going to happen or what's coming or what might happen or whatever, maybe I need to change my information diet. I haven't been on Reddit in like a month. I've never really used Twitter. I don't use Facebook. I'm just completely off of social media, which has been pretty good. And I also changed all the podcasts I listen to, and I just listen to like interesting science podcasts and stuff like that.
So I mean, part of it literally is ignoring it.
Yeah, because like do your best, try to put good out there.
Yeah,
and you don't need all that crap.
Well, it's kind of like – it's again, it's that refraction problem, which is like whatever you're irradiating yourself with is just kind of where you are. You know what I mean? So like if you're reading the news every single morning, if the first thing you do is like read the news, just stop it. Just
– you're giving yourself thought cancer.
Yeah, and it's not only that either, but it's like – yeah, there are so many bad things happening. There are also a whole bunch of really good things
happening. Yeah, there are. That shit's not going to go in the news because it doesn't move copies. About
that. And of course like the bad stuff is the stuff that's going to kill us all, right? So like – so you could focus on that, except like,
well, as organisms that evolved in a space where things were trying to eat us a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was always more advantageous to be extremely perceptive of danger and risk and always take note of it.
Yeah.
You know,
but without worrying about relative risk.
Yeah. Which is why like anytime, like if you're, let's say you're in bed sleeping and you like hear a noise, your immediate thought is, oh, fuck. So there's something there, right? And then it's a radiator or like,
and that does happen, of course, right?
Yeah.
But almost every time that noise happens, that's completely fine,
right?
And almost every single time.
And so, like, as an animal, which you are, you're primed to constantly be aware of things that are trying to get you, right?
Yeah. No matter how unlikely it is,
right? And so, so because of that, the same thing applies to information. Like you want to always try to be aware of pieces of information that might keep you from getting got.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so you seek it out.
This is where that like a sort of like outrage culture kind of stuff comes into play, or where was that? If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
You know, which is like anything that happens that could be somewhat negative or somewhat dangerous or harmful, people just, you got to jump on it and spread it around to make sure everybody knows about this thing that's going on. And it's also weirdly addictive.
Yeah.
You know, to seek that stuff out.
I would suggest changing some of your habits around the information you're bringing in. You know, if you read the news every day, just check it once a week.
Yeah, but also change your framing on it, because I think it's important to still be informed about what's going on. It's still important where if you can make changes to your own life just to be a better person and to treat the world better, to treat each other better, then you should do that. If you are in a position of power where you can actually broadly influence things that are tied to this, then like if you're listening to this podcast and you're the CEO of a coal company, then maybe burn that thing to the ground.
You know? Yeah, actually, no, don't do it. Bury it or something.
Bury it. Put it back in the mountain.
Put it back in the mountain. So there are people out there who actually can do some things and they should. But the other thing is, from a framing perspective, is so for me, like I've just personally accepted the reality that we're not going to stop global warming, and that's going to happen, right? As a consequence, I will not ever move to a coast. That's not going to happen, right? Because coasts are going to be underwater.
If you're on a coast, sometime over the next 30 years –
maybe get a plan together.
Start migrating inland.
That's exactly it. Well, but also in terms of like how the weather is changing, because most of it we don't know. But there are lots of predictions out there about where the things are going to happen. Like if I was living in a place like the if I was living in a place that had high likelihood to become a desert.
Which is possible.
Which is possible.
Where we are.
Here actually is not super likely, but again, like the coasts are the most fucked just everywhere, really.
Yeah. That's going to be real wet.
Yeah. That's where the most change are going to happen. It's going to be a combination of really wet and really dry, you know?
And also big storms are going to hit you right in the face.
Yep. Yeah. So I would like for the United States, I would get way off of the East Coast because like those hurricanes are going to be coming faster and stronger every year now, just for the rest of time. So the way that I would see it is what actionable steps can I take? Not necessarily to fix the problem because you can't as an individual, but to insulate myself and my community, the people I care about, from those problems as much as I can.
Well, this is the gray rhino.
Yeah.
Right? Like we have a pretty decent sense of the kinds of things that are going to be happening 5, 10, 20, mm-hmm. 30 years from now because of what's going on now.
Yep.
And those things are going to continue. We're going to continue to know about them and they're going to continue to be there.
So don't actually ignore them. Just like take whatever steps you can. So make sure you've got
– And it's going to be a painful process in some cases. Yeah. But like mm-hmm. – try to just be aware. Yeah.
So if you know that like natural disasters are going to be more common, so read up on what it takes to survive a natural disaster. Stock up on water. Do that kind of stuff, right? Just like
– Not just to a crazy degree.
Don't go crazy, no. But just
– But the reality is action is a good balm for anxiety.
That is also
100%.
And so – Even if it doesn't accomplish anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So find a few things that you can actually do, you know, that are related to these and then do those things. And otherwise wean yourself off of the addiction of paying attention to the terror.
Also – Yes. Also, be really religious about getting up to date on your vaccines.
Yes,
because
please.
It used to be the case that even if you forgot, it would be fine because most people didn't forget.
Not anymore.
But not anymore. So stay real up to date on those things. Those of us who understand it are the last bastion of keeping the world insulated from an entire
and also this is
disease apocalypse.
Yeah, this is one of those like, yeah, we're game developers. Adam is a PhD biologist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like. This isn't
this isn't a bunch of game players. Yeah. Yeah. Armchair quarterback.
This isn't like somebody who did some Googling and found and like came up with some crap about vaccines or something. Yeah. This is genuine. Like, do it. Get your fucking vaccine.
Yeah, it is unethical to not be vaccinated.
Yeah,
is a fact.
All right, next question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. Why is 60 FPS a thing? Why is it not 50 FPS? It would make more sense because there are 1,000 milliseconds in a second, so dividing would be a logical number. If it was 600 frames per minute, I could understand because then you would have a round number. It'd also be a slideshow, but that's
– So the question is
– it's still 60 FPS.
The first question is what is FPS?
Frames per second.
Which means what?
So
what's a frame?
It's basically how often the picture changes.
Yeah. So the way that a game works is it happens in a loop where basically the computer will process everything. Maybe you have a bullet that's flying across the screen or something. So every frame, the computer is like, well, the bullet's going this fast, so now it's here. And then that's where it is
now. You do that 24 times over every second or 30 or 60 times over every second.
Whatever your frame rate is, that's how quickly you run that loop. Yeah.
So the faster the frame rate, the smoother the appearance of stuff on the screen is, right? So you can imagine if you went all the way down to like one frame per second, now you're looking at like a real weird GIF.
You're looking at a slow GIF or a fast slideshow. Yeah.
If you're at like, I don't know, maybe 24 is what That's all the animated cartoons used to be in. I think they're – I don't know if they're still on.
YouTube is typically at 30.
You used to be 30.
Or 29.4.
So 29.97 is also another one. I don't know why the fuck that's the case.
I'm pretty confident that pretty much all of these frame rates come from basically two requirements. One is it's got to be fast enough for the content that you don't feel weird and jittery watching it, right? Mm-hmm. So like
– And slow enough that you can – for the content that you don't have to store too much of it or create too much.
Right. So it's a combination of file sizes. It's a combination of what it is you're looking at. So for a film, actually, they will record it with a camera that will capture whatever the frame rate is, which means that if something is moving quickly, then it has motion blur.
Yep.
So it's okay that there's like a small gap in time because your brain fills in the motion, right? And on a PC game – before we had motion blurring technology, we just needed a higher frame rate in order to get that feeling of smooth motion, without it feeling like things were jumping around. So I don't know why it's 60. I don't know why it's not 50. Maybe 50 was too slow for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's also part of
it. It is the thing about biology, right? It's like biology is very like how fast our eyes process information. It is very fast. Like so, the difference, a 10-millisecond difference, is actually significant, right?
Yeah.
And so yeah, so jumping from 50 to 60, like it is quite possible that 60 just is some magic number where it's like just fast enough, right?
Yeah.
But it's like the minimum. It's like the minimum fast enough that is basically everything is pretty smooth.
Yeah. If you want a really good, actually a good example of this, the new Spider-Man movie, the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse animated movie.
Oh yeah.
I think it's just animated on twos. So it's every two frames and they don't do any motion blur whatsoever. And so at first, when you first start watching it, it feels kind of choppy.
Yeah.
Because there's literally no motion blur. And so what that means is that you really see each frame almost while it's working. And then your brain sort of settles into it and you literally don't even fucking notice. Yeah. But you can definitely feel it.
There is that moment at the beginning.
Yes, if you want to kind of an example of that. But they did that on purpose because motion blur also makes things fuzzed a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It reduces sort of the cartoon or comic quality of it.
Yeah, because they wanted it to feel like a comic book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so literally, it's basically a comic book that is
turning very fast.
Horrifyingly, yeah, huge in terms of volume, right? Which is amazing.
So, yeah, there's not probably a good exact, like, this is why it's 60.
I mean, there is some reason out there.
It's just, it's fast enough. And
there's also a really good chance it has something to do with hardware. Some legacy thing.
Well, but also bear in mind that every frame for a video game is not a graphical thing.
Right.
It's also a CPU thing.
Yeah, computational.
Right? So like, if you wanted 120 frames per second, for example, then your processor would have to do twice as many computations per second, which means it's going to run hotter. You're going to be able to do fewer things in the game because you now have to do twice as many computations, right? And so there's kind of like everything just kind of comes to a balance.
To be clear, is that because a frame is a snapshot of what's going on, right? And so you have to figure out what's happening. It's a moment in time. You have to figure out what's happening in that snapshot. And so in a game, this is just referred to as the step, right? So each step is basically you compute a whole bunch of things to figure out what's going on right now, right? So you compute just a huge set of just all the things that are happening until you finished. And now you say, I know what's happening in this moment in time.
Display it.
And you have to do that at the frame rate. You have to do it once every, 60th, or I guess 60 frames per second. Yeah, once every 60th of a second or whatever, right?
16 milliseconds.
Yep. And so the more stuff that you have to compute, the lower of a frame rate you need, so there's more time in between frames that you can actually finish computing all of this stuff, which of course also why frame rates drop the more computationally complex.
Yeah, I will say it is a really weird thing to see people get up in arms about.
Yes.
The whole like locked versus unlocked frame rate debate, which occasionally bursts into the open on PC.
Mm-hmm.
Where players will get real mad about whatever the frame rate for the game.
Yeah, because we could actually update the game so that you could change your frame rate in the game to like 144 or whatever, mm-hmm. like whatever it is that your monitor is. But the fact is, like, there's a certain point where it doesn't really matter in terms of like what you're able to perceive. I do think that like up to 90 or 100, you can still kind of tell. But it's also the case that at a certain point, there's enough things happening in the game that the frame rate will drop below what you set it to.
Yeah.
Right? Because like we have
– can't – it just can't possibly compute all the things that have to be computed in that short of a period of time.
Yeah. Because it's not just graphics. It's the CPU. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, if level head's locked at 60, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Also note that because of the fact that you're not doing – things aren't happening continuously. They're happening on a frame-by-frame basis. Then things like physics and that kind of stuff, things that are continuous in real life that you're simulating in the context of a game, it is necessarily being simulated on a discrete basis. So you're taking something that was continuous and making it discrete,
which makes for some very funny errors.
Yes, because when you do that, you lose information, right? Yeah. And so the more frames that you have, the closer you get to actually continuous, right? Because if you had an infinite frame rate.
You have the real world.
Then you have the real world now, right? Like everything is happening so fast that you're perfectly mimicking what's going on. If you take it all the way down to zero, you just captured one moment of time. Yeah, and that's it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something to be aware of too is that physics engines actually may depend on the frame rate. Actually, that's not true. They always depend on the frame rate because they have to make a calculation every time and their next calculation is based on the prior one.
Mm-hmm.
And so the depending on what your frame rate is, the size of the error, the relative size of the error is different.
Yeah,
and that adds up actually.
And also, honestly, this is where so much time has gone into level head is trying to work out frame rate specific. Yeah.
So specifically, like one of my favorite bugs that results from stuff like this is basically the problem where if an object is moving too fast in a game, then, and it sort of updates every step, for example. So every frame is updating to determine where the location of this object is. And maybe the object is supposed to collide with like a wall or something. Mm-hmm. But
it doesn't know that until that step, right?
It doesn't know it until it actually hits the wall.
Yeah.
Right. And the problem is that sometimes the object is going so fast that the calculation on step one is sort of before it's actually hit the wall. And the calculation on step two, it's actually on the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
And so it never hit the wall. And so you end up with these hilarious problems where – and we actually have this in Levelhead where at certain points players can do something like they can use the charge punch of the Waylay power-up to go so fast that if you sort of perfectly time it, you can skip a wall tile. So you can actually skip across a wall.
Right? You can't go through a wall. We use continuous collision checking for that, which is basically –
we had to update that, right? Because it wasn't happening before.
You would originally be able to do that. But you can still jump through hazards with that.
Yeah.
Which are not treated as solid by the continuous collision checking, and it says so you could like jump through a spike or something like that.
And so there's a couple of these, and they're I find those ones very interesting.
Yeah, but now imagine if you, because we need to make it sure that the game still feels good when people are playing it. So now let's say you on your BVPC make a level that where you get going really fast or whatever, and you run into a wall normally, right? And then somebody else plays that level, but now they have it on a lower frame rate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they go all the way down to 30. So now actually. Half as many of the
steps
time points actually have any computations even happening. And so now it's twice as likely that you're going to be able to go right through that wall or whatever it is, right? So frame rate has a huge impact
on what happens in the game. We had some goofy shit in Levelhead 2 where some people have computers that hitch.
Yeah.
Where like maybe they're running at a smooth frame rate generally, but every now and then maybe they've got Dropbox running in the background and there's some shit going on, right? And the CPU just doesn't have the resources all the time to process the game. So instead, maybe like they're at 60 frames per second and then for like one frame, it takes them like three times longer, right? So it's like 60 FPS, boom, 20 FPS, and then right back up to 60 again. So there was a time where we would use for example, the distance that a moving platform traveled in the previous frame to determine how you inherit the velocity of that platform when you jump off.
Oh, yeah. I loved this one.
So so it'd be like, okay, well, it's been this amount of time since the platform moved, and this is how far it moved, et cetera. So when you jump, then you will fly.
You'll basically inherit speed off the platform.
Yeah. But because of that hitching thing.
Then you moved a lot further.
You moved a lot further, and for whatever reason, because of the way that the hitch would hit the game engine, I couldn't seem to like – compensate for that. And so instead you would just get shot off of the platform like a bullet.
So but the thing is like the hitch was literally a frame hitch usually. So the frame rate would drop literally for a single frame.
Yeah.
And so you wouldn't even detect that this
happened. That happened.
And then you just go to jump and it would just fire you off like a bullet. Just like because you're actually going, you know, like what, four times as fast or something essentially because of the frame rate dip.
So
which was hilarious.
It was hilarious, but pretty bad because you can't beat a lot of levels if you get thrown to your death.
Yep,
so.
Yes, that is true.
Looking forward to making a slower pace game.
Oh my God, yeah. After working on Levelhead, because also Levelhead is a UGC game, which means like
– players do insane stuff that we wouldn't do.
Well, they abuse the fact that frame rate impacts
this is the thing that it's like – it's both really hilarious and awesome to have a UGC game because you get to see all the wacky shit that the players come up with. But it's also endlessly frustrating as a game designer because we don't get to dictate what kind of experience our users have.
Yeah.
Like a player can come in and if one person says, oh my God, I just discovered that if I put this many items – and actually like just this past week some of our players in the Discord were talking about what they could do to get the frame rate as low as possible and still be able to publish the level, right? Yeah.
So it becomes a sort of – basically the UGC aspect becomes a game in terms of like who antagonizing can break the physics the developers.
Yeah.
Which is
And nobody – it's like as a designer, when we are trying to sell our game, the only questions we ask revolve around how do we deliver the best experience to our players?
Yes.
And the questions that our players ask is how do I abuse this glitch?
Well,
and
they have no – because not, it's fun to build around.
Right, right. And so they're not thinking about the game – as a whole, they're not thinking about what this might do to the community. Like, let's say somebody comes into the game and their first five levels they play are frame rate abuse levels, right?
That can't even be played on that person's device because they can't have their frame rate doesn't behave the same way.
So, somebody buys Levelhead, they come in, and all that happens is their CPU melts because people have been abusing the frame rate or something. And the the creators of those levels, that's fine. Like that's, they were having a good time, but that was what mattered, right? And so much of the work that we've had to do has just been like, how do we keep this from being too bad of a
That's why the campaign exists, honestly, because we understand that like part of the fun part of participating in a UGC experience is building stuff that is antithetical to people having a good time. it's actually about you building. It's not about
a troll level in its own way.
It's about you doing, having the fun of exploiting something, right? It's not actually about the end product at all.
Yeah.
And so that's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah. So next game, I'm excited to make like an RPG or something where like we get to deliver
the entire
content.
Yeah.
We get to be like, this one thing is really bad for the frame rate. Let's not put 1,000 of those in one spot.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, well, that's all the time we have for this week's episode.
Yeah.
But we're going to
– it's not all the time that we have. Yep. We have an entire other hour left.
Yeah. So we'll get on that and
see you next week.
We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Costa, for putting this episode together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net. We have links to everything. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. Goodbye.